KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Katie Jane and the Celtic Light Orchestra performance on Saturday, January 25th from 7 to 9 p.m. at the Community Music Center in Portland. Katie Jane and the Celtic Light Orchestra combine Celtic music, interactive lights, Irish dancing, and fun. Pre-show attendees are invited to participate in the Magical Music Petting Zoo, where they can touch and play instruments that inspire the creative mind. Again, that's the Katie Jane and Celtic Light Orchestra performance on Saturday, January 25th from 7 to 9 p.m. at the Community Music Center, 3350 Southeast Francis Street in Portland. This is an all-ages show. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
It is 2 o'clock, and you are listening to KBOO Portland.
You're listening to a Hindsight 2020 special, The Cost of a Better Life, Debriefing Immigration Policy Under the Trump Administration. Thanks for joining us. I'm Jezaniah Hawthorne. We'll spend the hour examining the impacts of immigration policy over the past 3 years. Immigration is a hefty topic to unpack, especially under this administration, considering building a wall on the U.S.-Mexico border was a foundational aspect of Donald Trump's 2016 campaign. So to better understand how we ended up here, we need to dig a little deeper. First off, what caused the surge in migration from Central America? The Northern Triangle of Central America, comprised of El Salvador, Guatemala, and Honduras, is currently considered one of the most dangerous places in the world. A 2014 U.S. Department of Homeland Security document cited rural poverty and extreme violence was the motivator for the surge in numbers of unaccompanied children apprehended at the border. In 2014, Honduras had the highest murder rate in the world, with El Salvador right behind it. However, El Salvador's homicide rate presently has surpassed Honduras. The major gangs accredited to the violence in Central America are M18 and MS-13. Both gangs were formed in Los Angeles. After the passage of the Illegal Immigration Reform and Immigrant Responsibility Act in 1996, the U.S. began deporting many of these gang members, which many believed accelerated the gang's operations, bringing a Los Angeles gang culture to Central America. Although the actual percentage of homicides attributed to gangs in Central America remains controversial, the gangs have exercised their power through rampant criminal activities such as kidnapping, human trafficking, extortion, and drugs, auto, and weapon smuggling. In 2010, in response to anti-gang legislation, the two gangs jointly warned public transportation operators to stay home for 3 days or face retaliation. The threats paralyzed the country's transportation system. According to a government figure, approximately 387,000 people have been displaced from the Northern Triangle due to violence and poverty. Another preface, it's easy to place the entirety of the blame on the Trump administration for the insurgence of cruel immigration policy, and believe me, we're going to get into it. But we need to remember that Donald Trump is a symptom of corruption. He is not the cause, and we can't give him that much credit. According to a Princeton University study researching the influence of public opinion on laws passed by Congress, the average citizen had little to no impact on the The combination of corruption and the modern Republican ideology is what led to Trump's election in the first place. The conservative ideology that we know today was formed by the New Right movement of the 1960s and 70s in response to rising liberalism, crime, homosexuality, and the civil rights movement. Trump is not the first Republican to rally support on the grounds of racism. A hallmark of the New Right movement was the 1964 presidential campaign of Barry Goldwater, who strongly opposed the Civil Rights Act in order to win the support of white Southerners. But political parties aside, and as we all know, racism runs deep in the roots of American history. Therefore, immigration policy has made little progress. The Bush and Obama administration were not much better than the Trump administration and actually statistically deported more people. However, Donald Trump has created the crisis at the border by prioritizing any illegal border crosser, which clogged the system. In the last fiscal year, the Trump administration held on average 42,000 people a day. This is 30% higher than the average over the Obama years. And the amount of people being arrested for only violating the immigration law of crossing the border has risen by 44%. What really sets this administration apart from previous administrations is that their policies are intentionally cruel, a tactic used to prevent others from attempting to migrate to the U.S. On top of that, Trump has been so brash and blatantly racist in his rhetoric, disseminating an us versus them mentality.
Best and the finest. When Mexico sends its people, they're not sending their best. They're not sending you. They're not sending you. They're sending people that have lots of problems, and they're bringing those problems with us. They're bringing drugs, they're bringing crime, they're rapists, and some, I assume, are good people.
That was Donald Trump's presidential announcement speech in June 2015. Majority of claims he made on his campaign trail were unfounded, which is not surprising. The majority of migrants and women and children, the majority of them are migrant women and children escaping gender-based violence, gang recruitment or prostitution, human trafficking, and persecution. The dehumanization and inaccurate characterization of immigrants was the cornerstone of Trump's campaign. He framed the white working class as victims of globalization, blaming immigrants and progressive ideals for their suffering. According to a study by Harvard University and Canadian Institute for Advanced Research, Trump used the word immigrants and or immigration 364 times in his 73 campaign speeches, and very rarely was it in a positive light. Quote, "This election is our last chance to secure the border, stop illegal immigration, and reform our laws to make your life better." That was in 2016. Trump continually used refugees and immigrants as scapegoats to create support for his xenophobic agenda. According to a study produced at the University of Northern Texas, counties that hosted a 2016 Trump campaign rally saw a 226% increase in reported hate incidents in comparison to counties that did not host Trump rallies. On a national scale, the FBI found that violent hate crimes have reached a 16-year high. But honestly, it doesn't take statistics to see the rise in white supremacy and its correlation to a president with such inflammatory rhetoric. From personal experience, I witnessed coworkers and acquaintances slowly emerge from the shadows and common decency that they hid behind as they slowly grew more confident in their flawed and disturbing ideologies. Here's a quote from a white supremacist organizer, Rachel Pendergraft, quote, "The success of the Trump campaign just proves that our views resonate with millions," end quote. Donald Trump's legacy will always be associated with the revival of racism and white nationalism. Of course, racism has always been prevalent in our society, but Donald Trump was like a mascot that gave them the audacity to step into the light again. Although Donald Trump heavily focused on Latin American immigrants, his unrelenting xenophobia did not stop there. During the 26th campaign, Trump called for a, quote, "total and complete shutdown of Muslims entering the United States until our country's representatives can figure out what the hell is going on," end quote. Competing candidates on both sides of the aisle condemned such comments. When Trump took office, one of the first executive orders, commonly referred to as the Muslim ban, barred entry to the U.S. of citizens from Iraq, Syria, Iran, Libya, Somalia, Sudan, and Yemen for 90 days. It also halted the entry of Syrian refugees indefinitely. The executive order reduced the cap of refugees accepted into the U.S. in 2017 from 110,000 to 50,000. Giving priority to refugees escaping religious persecution. In an interview, Trump implied that Christian refugees would be of the most importance. The ban also suspended the U.S. refugee admissions program for 120 days, and exceptions could be made on a case-by-case basis. The absurd and abrupt ban created chaos at U.S. airports and left many foreigners in limbo. Here's some of their experiences.
The ban has affected us so much. We are so worried that we're not even eating. We don't know what to do. It has crushed all our hopes. It has changed our lives. We've been here for 27 years. Our country is not safe, so we thought we would get safety and security in the U.S.
The U.S. has rejected me, and I was hoping to get a good education and a better future. Here in Kenya, I'm not getting any of that, and I can't go back to Somalia. I am very worried.
Of the seven countries banned, I think Somalis are the worst hit because our country is in trouble and we are discriminated against in many places. So we thought the U.S. was the only country that will give us refuge.
That was Fasia Mohammed and Fatuma Hassan, two Somali refugees interviewed by the BBC. Facia had waited 3 years for her resettlement application to process and was preparing to travel to the U.S. when the travel ban took effect. When she said, "We have been here for 27 years," she was referring to the refugee camp in Kenya. The second speaker was born in the refugee camp and is now 18. Many civil rights groups and foreign leaders were appalled by the move and believe it would do little to address terrorism. The ban sparked massive protests and lawsuits from civil rights groups. Just a week after the order was issued, a Seattle federal judge suspended the ban nationwide, arguing that the order violated the U.S. Constitution that prohibits the favoring of one religion over another. The Trump administration requested an immediate reinstatement of the order by the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals in San Francisco, but was rejected. The Trump administration made revisions to create a new executive order in March 2017. Which now discluded Iraq from the list of countries and exempted people with current visas and green cards. The new order also removed language about religious minorities and the indefinite banning of Syrian refugees. The second executive order was blocked again. However, the Supreme Court allowed a partial ban in June 2017, exempting those with bona fide relationships in the U.S. The third version of the travel ban took effect in September 2017 and again was blocked initially. The latest version removed Sudan and added North Korea and Venezuela to the list. On June 26, 2018, the court upheld the ban in a vote 5-4. The vote 5-4 argued that the president was within his authority and it was not discriminatory. Trump claims the travel ban is not based on race or religion, but on national security. However, critics have cited that majority of recent U.S. attacks were domestic terrorists or from countries not on the ban. In 2018, the U.S. State Department had rejected more than 37,000 visas due to the ban. Predominantly Muslim countries suffered the most, with the number of visas issued to those countries dropping 80% compared to 2016. In recent news, the White House is considering expanding this ban. A document outlining additional countries to add to the travel ban has been circulating the White House. It is clear that Donald Trump's 2020 election campaign is still focused on immigration. Thank you so much for joining us today to debrief the last few years' immigration policy and its legacy. We'll be back after the short break. Such a fucking cliche. The way you define them and us, those you fear and those you trust. You know I'm that guy and he's very articulate. You know I'm Mexican and she's honest and diligent. You don't see color, but some people need discipline. A thug is a thug, some people need to learn a lesson. Justification, what's that giveaway? Qualification, what's that giveaway? You never endorse the Jim Crow days, but the malice in your voice is a goddamn giveaway. Just cause you don't know your fly. racist by anti-flag. You are listening to a Hindsight 2020 special, debriefing immigration policy under the Trump administration. I'm your host, Jezaniah Hawthorne. I wanted to add that anti-flag coincidentally just the same weekend as we're doing our Hindsight 2020 special released an album called 2020 Vision, and it's all about Trump, so if you're interested in that, check it out. So far, we've only scratched the surface. Next, we'll look at Trump's first executive action to impede immigration at the southern border. Most of the attention was on the forefront of the order to begin construction on a wall along the Mexican border and to withhold funding from sanctuary cities. But the executive order also drastically expanded who the government considered a priority for deportation. During the Obama administration, immigration policy included only specific criminal convictions, people ordered to be removed, or who entered or re-entered the country illegally after January 2014. Minor offenses such as shoplifting were on his list, but they were later removed because of public outcry. Under this executive order, Trump expanded on the previous immigration policy, adding, anyone who has been charged the criminal offense, even if it did not lead to a conviction, anyone who authorities have suspicion of breaking the law, anyone who has falsified documentation, such as a Social Security card, which is quite common, anyone who abused public benefits, the revival of programs that allow the federal government to work with local and state law enforcement agencies to arrest and detain unauthorized immigrants with criminal law enforcement agencies. And lastly, he endowed immigration officers with broad authority to target anyone they think may pose a risk to public safety and national security. Prior to this order, immigration officers required review from a supervisor before pursuing an individual. The executive order's grounds for priority deportation is so vast that it eliminates the actual prioritization altogether. The new enforcement essentially prioritizes any removable non-citizen. Leaving so much power to the enforcement officers has led to excessive racial profiling, and on several occasions they've arrested and detained U.S.-born citizens. The order also called for the hiring of 5,000 more Border Patrol agents and 10,000 more immigration officers. Additionally, it ordered DHS to expand the use of expedited removal of any undocumented non-citizen detained near the border who has a final order of removal or who cannot prove that they've been in the U.S. for at least 2 years. Expedited removal is a process to quickly deport and detain an immigrant without the opportunity to appear before an immigration judge. This was a huge setback for civil rights, considering it denied immigrants the right of due process. The expansion of expedited removal also has made it harder for people to claim asylum because they don't have a chance to seek legal help to file the application. Further orders to DHS demand the immediate construction of detention center facilities and the termination of catch and release. This is what's clogging the system, meaning people caught crossing the border illegally are released into the U.S. while they wait for their asylum application to be processed, a process that can take years. So how is this legal? Expedited removal was previously used only on immigrants described by the Supreme Court as in transit, meaning they had been in the country less than 2 weeks and were caught within 100 miles of the border. Therefore, they had not been in the U.S. long enough to qualify for due process rights. Through this executive action, the administration has expanded the limits of expedited removal much further. This shift away from prioritized deportation has been under fire by civil rights advocacy groups and faced public scrutiny. Here is a quote from Democratic Congressman Greg Stanton. Quote, rather than tracking down violent criminals and drug dealers, ICE is spending its energy deporting a woman with two American children who have lived here for more than 2 decades and pose a threat to nobody. And yet again, this was just the tip of the iceberg. In April 2018, the Trump administration announced a zero-tolerance policy. The policy called for the detention and prosecution of all immigrants who entered from an unofficial port of entry, including asylum seekers. This policy carried out a systematic separation of adults and accompanied child migrants. When illegal border crossers were caught, their children would be turned over to the Office of Refugee Resettlement and treated as if they traveled to the U.S. alone. However, multiple media outlets reported families who entered the U.S. through lawful ports of entry were also being separated. The administration had been considering the idea of family separation as a means of deterrence since March 2017. In the summer to follow, the Trump administration began a DHS pilot program in the border region of El Paso, Texas. According to a Border Patrol report, approximately 281 individuals and families were separated under that initiative. The government viewed the experiment as an effective deterrent and proceeded to implement it in a launch of the zero tolerance policy across the entire Southwest border by April. In January 2018, more than 200 experts in child welfare, juvenile justice, and child development organizations sent a letter condemning the use of family separation. The letter warned of a long-lasting and significant consequence for the health and well-being of children. The American Academy of Pediatrics, a nonprofit organization of 66,000 primary care pediatrics and specialists, also sent a letter to DHS in response to the practice, explaining such cruelty will result in trauma that can harm a developing brain, explaining that many of these children had already experienced traumatic events such as fleeing violence, and this policy would exacerbate their suffering. Family separation was among the most disturbing moves of the Trump administration. A New York Times op-ed piece said, quote, "Parents will continue to flee violence to protect their children and themselves. It is reprehensible to punish them for the basic human impulse. It is also despicable that the government would use children as bargaining chips. This policy is tantamount to state-sponsored traumatization." On January 20th, 2018, the administration bowed to public pressure, signing an executive order to reverse the family separation. However, the actual language of the order did no such thing. The order still permitted children to be taken away from their parents and also required the indefinite detention of family. The order did not address the reunification of the families that had already been separated, and the order also undermined the Flores settlement, which limited the amount of time a minor could be detained. Yuri Jadot, director of DHS Watch and former USCIS chief counsel, said, quote, "Now Trump is using this self-created crisis to set up a false choice for Americans to choose between ripping kids from their parents or indefinitely detaining families. Except Trump is, through this executive order, once again attempting to pull the wool over the eyes of the American people by making matters worse. He not only fails to clearly end family separation, but he requires detention of all, even without making the Faustian choice to keep families together that he claims to be doing. On top of that, Republicans in Congress are trying to hijack this moment to decimate asylum protections and our legal immigration system that reflect long-held American values," end quote. In February 2018, the ACLU filed a lawsuit against ICE on behalf of an asylum seeker mother and her 7-year-old daughter who had escaped violence from the Democratic Republic of Congo. The ACLU expanded the case to a class action lawsuit. In June 2018, a U.S. District Court judge issued a preliminary injunction that ordered the government to reunite all children under 5 years old to their parents within 14 days and 30 days for the rest of the kids. It became clear that DHS had no intention of reuniting these children due to the lack of records and contact information. At the time, a government figure indicated that over 2,000 children were separated from their parents or caregiver, but it was later determined that thousands more had been separated, but the exact figure is unknown. According to CNN, 463 parents had already been deported without their children, leaving them in custody of the U.S. government. Royce Murray, a policy director with the American Immigration Council, said many individuals were pressured by ICE to sign papers agreeing to deportation or giving up their asylum claims, as they would they were told that they would be reunited with their children faster. In November 2018, families were still being separated at the border. ProPublica reported the Trump administration was quietly continuing the practice through a loophole in the court ruling. The ruling allowed child separation only if the child's safety was at risk. CBP began using vague and unsubstantial allegations to claim a parent was unfit. CBP used minor violations such as illegal reentry and even traffic violations as justification. Lawyers at Catholic Charities, who provide legal services to migrant children in government custody, told ProPublica that they had many cases where a kid was placed in foster care because they didn't know in the foster care system because they didn't know from CBP that they had arrived with a parent. Due to the excessive and unnecessary separation of children from their parents, CBP created a child migrant crisis. The overcrowding led to a lack of resources such as food, beds, staff, medical attention, and sanitation. To combat the influx of child migrants in ORR custody, the Trump admin opened a tent city near El Paso, Texas in the summer of 2018. HHS claimed the measure was necessary to continue its vital mission of national security. That's what they told themselves anyways. Could anyone really believe children pose a threat to national security? The tent cities drew large public outcry. Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez called the detention camps along the southern border concentration camps. Many politicians either denounced or distanced themselves from the claim. However, many Jewish groups supported her analogy. Rabbi Salem Pierce, director of organizing at Jewish human rights organization TRUA, I hope I'm pronouncing that right, said, quote, "They're not death camps, not yet," she said. "But the death camps that have existed throughout history often don't start that way. They start being placed where people who are targeted because of their race or status are put into isolated places and denied due process. The characterization is accurate," end quote. According to various Jewish human rights organizers, the movement has seen aggressive growth in the fight against ICE. One group, Never Again Action, quickly formed and mobilized 38 protests throughout the country around ICE offices, detention centers, and private prisons. I believe Portland took part in one of these protests back in August 2019, and a friend of mine, shout out to Julia, she actually got arrested along with 11 others who were peacefully protesting outside the Portland ICE headquarters on Southwest McAdam Avenue. I kind of went off on a tangent, but if there is time, I would like to get into more ways that you can get involved locally. You're listening to a Hindsight 2020 special programming on KBOO Portland, and we'll be back after this break. Stay with us. That was Prayer for the Refugee by Rise Against. Thank you for tuning in. This is The Cost of a Better Life, debriefing immigration policy under the Trump administration. I'm Jezaniah Hawthorne. Before the break, we were looking at the public outrage brought on by CBP 10, yeah, CBP's tent cities. The camps were originally temporary. However, many children had been held there for months. Children in the camps did not have access to education or legal assistance, which violated the 1997 Flores Settlement, which detailed the standards of care and rights of immigrant children. By January 2019, at least four lawsuits were filed against the government's treatment of migrant children. One lawsuit argued that ICE had been arresting willing sponsors of the children if they were in the country illegally. In the year prior, 170 willing sponsors were detained, causing many children to remain in Health and Human Services custody. Another lawsuit went after HHS for intentionally making the process for sponsorship more difficult. Due to the constant constraints, those are air quotes, the Flores Agreement brought on to the Trump administration, the administration attempted to have it overturned, arguing that they should not be required to provide children with toothbrushes, soap, and beds. In June 2019, a group of attorneys representing the Flores settlement visited a Border Patrol center in Clint, Texas. Here is the senior researcher at Human Rights Watch, Clara Long, on Democracy Now! Describing the negligence that she saw while interviewing children at a CBP facility.
I was there as part of a team of lawyers and doctors who volunteer to monitor these facilities on behalf of the Flores settlement, which is a decades-old legal settlement between the government and lawyers for children who are detained by immigration enforcement. And as part of that settlement, we don't actually have access to the location, so to the facility where, you know, to the whole facility where children are being detained. What we can do is speak to them because they're class members. Basically, they are clients. So we were sort of placed in this anodyne, you know, interview room and given a roster of children who were in the facility. And when we got there on Monday, we got this roster, and it showed that there were over 350 children in the facility from 0 to 17 years old. And so we said, okay, we're just going to start calling the youngest kids. We're going to start calling the kids who, the young parents. There were some young mothers there with infants. And we're going to try to talk to the kids who, it appears, based on this list, may have been here for the longest. And when the kids came into the interview rooms where we were sitting, one of the things we noticed was that we were calling kids who were listed as being 2 or 3 years old, and they were indeed alone in the facility. They would come into the interview room, usually together with a somewhat older kid, and the agents would say, oh, this kid is taking care of that other kid. And indeed, what the kid said was, if you talk to the older kid, often these toddlers were pre-verbal. Oh, yeah, I've been taking care of, taking care of this toddler, because there's no one else to do it, and they're in my cell with me. So, I've been, changing their diapers, giving them food, making sure they're okay. And that was sort of how those interviews went. We ended up understanding from the kids that Minnie had been there for weeks, and the kid who had been there the longest, who we spoke with, had been there for 26 days, and that's staying in these conditions that are really inappropriate for anyone for that amount of time, much less for a child. They hadn't been able to change their clothes for the most part. If they had gotten a shower or a bath, it was on the level of, say, once a week. Same thing with toothbrushes. In fact, they would say, we were allowed to brush our teeth, say, once a week, but then they told us we had to throw away the toothbrushes because you can't have them in the cell because they're contraband. So they wouldn't let them sort of take that kind of item back into these jail cells. A lot of them said, there are some beds, there are some mattresses, but, kids do also have to sleep on the floor because they're just not enough. That's the facility that, after we decided that it was so urgent, we had to speak out. Oh, let me say just quickly, the other thing that really concerned us from the perspective of urgency was that many of the kids we called were visibly sick, running noses. Some of the younger kids had mucus-stained clothing. And then many of the kids we asked to speak with, they said, no, you can't speak with that child because they're in quarantine. We said, we'll go to the quarantine room, no problem. We'll send some team members to the quarantine room and have them immediately leave the facility if you're worried about us spreading infectious diseases. They said no. They never gave us access to these quarantine rooms, and we called a sort of a significant number of kids, almost, I believe, 10 kids at least, who they said we couldn't see because they were in quarantine. At one point, I had this really quiet second grader who came into the interview room, and she sort of sat, you know, she came in and she sat on this big office chair, and she was like grabbing the sides of the chair. She was like sort of bracing herself. And I asked her one question. You know, I said, hello, I invited her, you know, to speak and asked if she wanted to speak. And she said, okay. And I said, you know, who'd you cross the border with? And she said, my aunt. And then she just started crying so hard that she couldn't produce words. And, trying to calm her down, rubbing her back and looking and seeing that she had a bracelet on with the words in permanent marker, the words U.S. parent and a phone number. Someone had taken the time to write that down, I guess, when they separated her from her adult relative, her custodian with whom she crossed the border. So I at that point, there's this sense that you're not allowed to use your phone in the facilities. But at that point, I and other members of our team just decided, you know, screw that. We're gonna start making phone calls. So I picked up my phone and dialed the number and connected with her father. He had no idea where she was being held. They were able to speak. And after that, she, you know, was able to sort of ask for more phone calls because she realized that, you know, phone calls might be a possibility. She was the only one who I saw with a bracelet with the parent's phone number. But there were so many kids who do have parents in the United States. I mean, another group of brothers who I spoke with had traveled with an older sibling to the U.S., a 19-year-old sister, and the sister was the one who had the parents' contact information, but they separated these kids from their adult sister so suddenly at the border that they were left with none of their parents' contact information, and they were distraught. They felt like they would never connect with their parents again.
That was Clara Long. Let's see. Senior researcher at Human Rights Watch. After hearing that, I can't imagine my niece and nephews experiencing that. It actually genuinely brings tears to my eyes. Let's see. Another interviewer in the group, Holly Cooper, co-director of Davis Immigration Law Clinic at the University of California, told the Associated Press, quote, "In my 22 years of doing visits with children in detention, I have never heard of this level of inhumanity." Another lawyer described what they saw in their visit, quote, "Flu and lice outbreaks were ongoing, untreated, and children were filthy, sleeping on cold floors and taking care of one another because of the lack of attention from the guards. Some of them had been in the facility for weeks." Thankfully, the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals was not impressed with the arguments made by the administration, ruling that the Flores Agreement would be upheld. In June 2019, Congress passed a $4.5 billion emergency border aid package to fund the housing of the influx of immigrants. The bill divided Democrats in that many of them believed the funding would just enable the abuse of more immigrants. Democrats made sure the funding could not be shifted to support the construction of Trump's border wall. ICE and CBP have had several allegations of mistreatment, neglect, and abuse in their facilities. In April 2018, The Intercept reported 1,224 complaints of sexual abuse in immigration detentions from 2010 to 2017. One woman was raped in a contracted facility by medical staff. A man in ICE custody was threatened to engage in oral sex with an officer or face deportation. Another woman recounted being handcuffed, maced, and then violated by an ICE agent. The man later filmed her showering. This is just a few of the accounts of horror immigrants have had to face in the custody of the federal government. The data suggests that sexual assaults and harassment in immigration detention are not only extensive, but also systematic. Of the 1,224 allegations of abuse, only 43 were actually investigated. When a group of congressmen visited Texas facilities in July 2019, they painted a grim picture of what they saw in the detention centers. Among those who visited, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez sharply criticized the conditions. She tweeted, quote, "Officers were keeping women in cells with no water and had told them to drink from the toilet. This was them on their good behavior in front of members of Congress," end quote. Earlier that week, ProPublica published posts from a Facebook group made up of current and former Border Patrol agents. Among the posts were jokes about the death of a 16-year-old Guatemalan girl who died in U.S. custody. There was also obscene comments and illustrations made about Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. Here's what her response was when asked about the disturbing post by CNN.
In that last facility, I was not safe from the officers in that facility. I mean, I think it's just just indicative of the violent culture that we saw on the inside as well.
Several top Democrats, including Homeland Security Chairman Benny Thompson, demanded the agents who made these vile comments to be fired. AOC and many other progressives fought for humanitarian aid bill that would allow unannounced visits of congressmen to these facilities. However, the final passing of the bill did not contain this additional clause. In February 2019, Ted Deschutes, a Democrat from Florida, released documents detaining thousands of accusations of sexual assault of minors in U.S. detention centers. The Common Dream detailed personal accounts. In one case, a 15-year-old Honduran girl reported that a CBP officer put his hands in her bra and pulled down her underwear during a routine pat-down. The cruelty never ends. Here's a few more despicable actions that have taken place towards immigrants in the last few years. In 2018, it surfaced that a treatment center in Texas contracted to house immigrant youth was forcibly administering psychotropic drugs to children to manage their trauma. Staff allegedly told children that they would not be released or be able to see their parents until they took what they called vitamins. The Center of Human Rights and Constitutional Law filed a lawsuit arguing the drugs were being administered irresponsibly and without consent of their parents. A U.S. district judge ordered the children could no longer be medicated without parent consent or court authorization. However, later reports found that the detention centers continued the practice. In November 2019, DHS created a fake university designed to lure in international students who wanted to enter the U.S. ICE arrested 250 students on the grounds that they were abusing the student visa program. The federal government is believed to have collected millions of dollars in tuition from the fake university. No one filed a lawsuit or claim against the U.S. For collecting money from allegedly entrapping these students. An attorney for ICE and the Department of Justice claimed the students should have known it was not a legitimate university because there was no physical classes. In May 2019, DHS announced it would expand its biometric DNA testing program to start collecting the DNA and fingerprints of migrant children under the age of 14. Stephen Kong, a detention attorney with the ACLU's Immigrants Rights Project, responded to the announcement, quote, "This is yet another example of government using generalized security interests to conduct increasingly intrusive measures into the privacy and civil rights of individuals who are seeking asylum at the border." End quote. You're listening to The Cost of a Better Life, debriefing immigration policy under the Trump administration. We'll be right back.
Captain Hindsight!
You're listening to Hindsight's 2020, a day of special programming debriefing the last 3 years under the Trump regime.
Thanks for listening.
Sugar cane, dry ice, I'm straight. La, 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 la.
That was Icky Thump by The White Stripes. You're listening to a Hindsight 2020 special on immigration under the Trump regime. If you've ever seen the music video to that song, it takes place, the setting is like on a border of Mexico. And in the background, there's a sign that reads, "The Great Wall of Mexico under construction," which I found really interesting because this song came out in 2007. So that's kind of just interesting. Next, we're going to look at the horrible conditions that led to deaths in ICE and CBP custody. According to NBC's review of federal reports, there has been 24 deaths of detainees in immigration and customs enforcement custody during the Trump administration, bringing the total to 188 detainee deaths since 2003 when DHS was formed. The number per year is still below what it was at a 32 peak in 2004. According to lawsuit records, the Department of Homeland Security's lack of medical records, management, and technology has led to deaths and mistreatment at the border. Another report by Human Rights Watch asserted that ICE provided dangerously substandard care, which led to 15 deaths from 2015 to 2017. The report pointed to the delay and botched emergency care as a contribution to the deaths. The tally does not include the 6 child deaths under border control care in the past year, which are the first in decades. 3 children died from flu-related complications, 1 died from a serious bacterial infection, and 2 died from chronic conditions they had prior to crossing the border. A report late last year showed CBP rejected a Center for Disease Control and Prevention recommendation to administer flu shots to people in custody. These child deaths reveal the severity of inhumane conditions in government custody. These centers are dangerously overcrowded, leaving children in soiled clothes for days, sometimes weeks without bathing. CBP has also been holding children beyond the maximum limit defined in the Flores settlement. Last week, the House Homeland Security Committee's subcommittee on border security held a hearing on the child deaths in DHS custody. The DHS Office of the Inspector General confirmed that 3,400 minors were being held beyond the 72-hour limit, with 1,500 of them had been there beyond 10 days. Veronica Escobar, an El Paso Democrat, requested DHS and CBP preserve videos of children and adults that have passed in their custody. The CBP Commissioner Mark Morgan responded in a letter telling Escobar that the videos are routinely erased. Morgan noted that CBP policy does not specify video recording standards. 16-year-old Carlos Gregorio Hernandez Vasquez was the only child death to be caught on video. ProPublica was able to access the videos under public records laws and expose the contradictions in CBP reports. Sorry. The House committee hearing focused on the lack of transparency and concealing of information from DHS on behalf of Carlos's case. In July, CBP Commissioner John Sanders claimed minors were checked every 15 minutes. However, the video shows Carlos laying on the floor unresponsive for 4.5 hours. Also, 4 hours were unexplainably cut from the video, and the investigation is ongoing. The next subject I wanted to focus on is the use of for-profit prisons and detention centers. In August 2018, Reuters reported as many as 72% of immigrants in CBP and ICE custody were held in privately owned for-profit prisons, 2 of which, Geo Group and Core Civic, formerly known as Correction Corporation of America, both contributed to Donald Trump's presidential campaign and inauguration. In 2017, they earned a combined profit of $985 million from contracts with ICE. The detention of immigrants is a massive profit machine. From the overpriced phone calls to the vans and buses used to transport detainees, the list goes on. Healthcare, ankle monitors, drug testing, food services, all of them are outsourced to companies through lucrative contracts. The Trump administration has manipulated immigration policy to create an endless stream of revenue through the torture of innocent people. Although for-profits have tried to remain below the radar, immigrant rights groups have spread awareness for both the use of for-profit prisons and other companies supporting the industry. Tech companies such as Amazon, Planeteer, Microsoft, Dell, and Concur supply software to collect and store data. Planeteer designed the investigative case management system supported by Amazon's web service that has increased ICE operations of arrest by 42% from 2017 to 2018. And we're going to take another music break here. Thank you so much for joining us. You're listening to a Hindsight 2020 special, The Cost of a Better Life, Debriefing Immigration Policy Under the Trump Administration. I'm Jezaniah Hawthorne. So there's been so much to unpack. I've barely gotten into just the first few policies and their effects. There's so much more that I would like to cover, but we're running out of time on the hour, such as, I'm just going to kind of run through them really quick. The administration attempted to end temporary protected status. It attempted to end DACA, Deferred Action for Child Arrivals, which protects nearly 7,000 people. They denied asylum seekers on the grounds of, before we would accept asylum seekers on the grounds of if they were experiencing gender-based violence, gang violence, or domestic violence. But under one of the orders, they made it so asylum seekers, those weren't included in asylum claims. They were ineligible. Let's see. They also eliminated medical deferred action, which allowed parents to stay in the U.S. while their child was undergoing like serious medical like surgeries or whatever they were going through. I wanted to use a clip of AOC grilling the guy that made the call on this. I didn't have time to get it, but they made this choice at cost of other choices. They want to harm immigrants, to scare them out of being here. Let's see. They imposed fees for asylum and DACA applications, which has never been done before. I didn't even get to touch on the mass deportations of 2019 in Ohio, Tennessee, and Mississippi. A historian, Mai Ngai of Columbia University, said that the raids were ineffective, costly, and inhumane. Even though, let's see. Sadly, I don't have time to explain every horrendous crime against humanity that has occurred over the past 3 years' immigration policy. But to conclude all that I've shared today, when Donald Trump leaves office, he will leave behind a legacy of corruption, dishonor, and bigotry. Although he may have liberated many racists and white nationalists, he also inspired people like me and you to fight back. I remember waking up on the day of his election to the news. I felt so distraught and scared for all my loved ones in marginalized communities. Out of desperation, I started searching for ways to join the resistance. I ended up finding a lot of local groups fighting the cause. Among them was KABU. I wouldn't be here today if it wasn't for the abominable events that brought us here. I think in the future, when historians look back on our time, they'll see a wave of resilience echoing that of the civil rights movement. Never again is now. If you feel sick to your stomach after all the things you've heard today, as a compassionate human being should, it's time to mobilize. Reach out to your community and find out how you can get involved. I know it's easy to feel helpless, like your one body can't make much of a difference, but it simply isn't true, and I hear it all too often as an excuse why people don't step forward. Let's see. This is kind of a silly analogy, or a funny, or not silly, but it's an analogy to a kid's movie. If you've ever seen the movie Bug's Life, The grasshoppers continually bully and oppress the ants to serve them. And in one scene, the leader of the grasshoppers explains to the others why it's so important to silence the outspoken ant, the main character. He explains that the ants outnumber them, and if they have to nip bravery in the bud before the ants realize how much power they actually manifest. The corrupt few in our government send the message that you have no power in hopes it will prevent you from ever realizing your true potential. So just remember that we have the numbers. Call your representatives today and make sure you're registered to vote. If you oppose this administration, make sure to register as a Democrat so you can participate in the primaries and choose who will face off against Donald Trump in the 2020 election. Thank you for caring about your fellow human beings, and thank you so much for joining me this afternoon. I'm Jezaniah Hawthorne. Stay tuned for more Hindsight 2020 special programming.
You're listening to Hindsight's 2020, a day of special programming debriefing the last 3 years under the Trump regime.
What happened in international politics, environmental issues, immigration, and LGBTQ rights? What were the most censored news stories of the past 3 years? How is the fight against white nationalism progressing?
Captain Hindsight!
We spend this day looking back so we can spend the rest of the year working together towards justice, equity, and democracy with hope and determination. Thank you for listening.
KBOO Community Radio is working with Beautiful Portland to collect socks and blankets for those who are sleeping outside this winter. There is a collection box in the lobby of KBOO Radio, 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland, between Burnside and Ankeny. Donations are accepted Monday through Friday, 9 a.m. to 5 p.m.
Still a chance.